Chapter 9. The Computerized Office: Productivity Puzzles. The subtle risks of computers have not been their only unpleasant surprise. Their greatest paradox may be that it is still hard to evaluate their benefits where these promise to be greatest, in the most rapidly growing parts of the economy. There is little debate about the value of electronics in manufacturing and distribution. Robots still have limited applications, but nobody doubts that they sometimes can do things faster, better, and more cheaply than human workers. It is unlikely that any old-fashioned purchasing agent or software manager could match the performance of good software. For the widget masters and metal bashers of the world, computers usually improve speed and quality and reduce waste. But in manufacturing, too, consequences can be unexpected, especially the results of improved communication. Consider the U.S. garment industry. It has always been cheaper to make textiles and clothing in Asia than in rural America, let alone in New York City. What protected American manufacturing as much as tariffs and quotas was the flow of information. Even with airmail, it might take too long to send designs and patterns overseas. Fax and electronic mail have changed that, taking weeks off turnaround times. With air freight an option for higher-priced merchandise, a major advantage of North American and European manufacturers, closeness to the end customer, has been seriously eroded. By buying time cheaply, new technology works against those who used to have time on their side. The introduction of the IBM PC as the standard for personal computers in 1981, older rivals soon faded, though the Apple Macintosh made its debut as an alternative standard in 1984, launched a new era for office work and the service sector. Mainframes had long controlled the operation of large corporations and government bodies, from manufacturing control to the processing of tax forms. Microcomputers promised to transform medium-sized and small businesses that could never have considered buying a mini-computer costing tens of thousands of dollars. Book-length documents could be edited with ease. Complex financial calculations, previously demanding hours of work, could be completed and, when necessary, revised in seconds. Records that only a few years earlier would have needed a variety of awkward colored tabs or punch cards, plus long needles for sorting, could now be stored on inexpensive disks or tapes. Programming no longer required months or years of apprentices hip in the old Fortran and COBOL languages. Schoolchildren were mastering BASIC, and for those who worried that BASIC as an introduction led to bad programming habits, there were Pascal, Turbo Pascal, and a host of more exotic entries, from Ada to Xenix. Throughout most of the 1980s, it was hard to imagine services and white-collar work in general not becoming more productive. The cost of everything from random access memory, RAM, to disk storage space seemed to be shrinking by half every 18 months. One of the first things that computer users have discovered is that not trading up to the latest processor means foregoing many new products and software versions, and even losing support for older software. WordPerfect 5.1, introduced in 1989, runs fast on 286-class computers from the mid-1980s. WordPerfect 6.0 almost demands a 486-class machine, generally four or more times as fast as many Windows 3.1 applications did in the early 1990s. Microsoft's Windows 95 needs at least a fast 486 machine to run efficiently. If the automobile metaphor is apt at all, it would probably be best expressed as a salesperson having to take on a larger and larger territory, paying the same amount every 3 to 5 years for a vehicle, ultimately an airplane, with greater and greater range, but getting an ever smaller trade-in price for the last model. In 1992, I spent about the same for a Hewlett-Packard LaserJet 4 printer capable of 8 pages per minute than I had paid 7 years earlier for a fast Seito Daisy Wheel printer with less than 1/8 the speed. But unlike other consumer hardware, automobiles, cameras, my printer had lost nearly all of its resale value in 7 years, even though it was still in excellent working order and could produce Courier 10 text that was actually sharper and clearer than copy in the same font from my LaserJet. Even the retail trade-in value of the most unpopular automobile models is a bastion of stability by comparison. All the more surprising because aging cars need costly overhauls that most mechanical printers don't. Heavy-duty daisy-wheel printers are the massive, almost immortal elephants of office electronics. A school is now using mine. My experience was hardly isolated. The revenge effect of the explosion in computer performance is, as every excited new system buyer soon discovers, an implosion in value. In February 1994, a compact 486/66M machine with a list price of $4,654 was projected to keep only 17% of its retail value over 2 years, and only 6% after 3 years, 3% at wholesale. The wholesale and retail value in 3 years was listed as salvage. Meanwhile, as of 1995, the Internal Revenue Service still required computers to be depreciated over 5 years. Not only does resale value decline precipitously, the price of replacement systems actually does not go down. There was a saying in the 1980s that, quote, the system you always want costs $5,000, unquote, and for all the breakthroughs of the 1990s, this still seems to be the case for state-of-the-art products, especially portables. A new entry-level system still costs around $1,500, as it did in the days of the beloved Apple II, except that the product has many times the processor speed, memory, and storage capacity. Of course, cheap computers can still do a lot, but they can be the most expensive of all because they can become socially obsolete, unable to run new releases of important software efficiently, within a year, if not months. Some popular online services are already unavailable for DOS-only computers. Upgrades may be disappointing. The price of additional memory chips, for example, has not declined as much as the prices of other components. It fluctuates with demand and is most likely to increase when users need it most to support more powerful operating systems. By the mid-1990s, a 340 or 528 megabyte hard drive is a near necessity for handling bulky program and graphics files. These numbers in turn demand a high-capacity tape backup, and many new software packages are now written to be delivered on CD-ROM, requiring yet another hardware addition. The wish to run several programs concurrently using graphic interfaces like Microsoft Windows or OS 2 prods users to upgrade from 14 and 15-inch to 17-inch and larger monitors. Meanwhile, business travelers who at first demanded smaller and lighter notebook computers can now add portable printers, with batteries good for only about 30 pages, wireless transmitters, CD-ROM drives, and speakers, bringing total weight and price back up to the days of the original compact luggables and beyond. The huge investment in computing in the 1980s and early 1990s then reflected one of the great cultural inversions of our time. North American and European corporations and millions of professionals, small business people, academics, and students learned to stop worrying and love planned obsolescence. If the watchword of the 1970s was survival, that of the 1980s was empowerment. People felt autonomous, in control, more powerful, and absolutely more productive. But toward the end of the 1980s, the sentiment grew that something was not right. Throughout the decade, scholars like the sociologist Rob Kling and the political scientist Langdon Winner were pointing out that computerization was a movement that reflected social conflict and organizational infighting as much as technical change. By the 1990s, a new set of critics had joined them. Unlike the social scientists, philosophers, and technophobic humanists who had long challenged the cult of productivity at all costs, the new skeptics approved of capitalism, higher output, technology, and all the rest. They had emerged from within technocratic culture, from economics departments, business schools, and consulting firms, and their message was that things weren't happening according to plan. The service sector, where the potential for gains was greatest, was strangely lagging. Intuitively, it is hard to believe that huge investments in improving the quality of anything will not pay off in the long run. There is a brilliant, well-supported argument that we are actually in the early stages of a more fundamental revolution. In a famous article, the economist Paul A. David has compared the early results of microcomputer use with the introduction of small electric motors to an industrial world formerly dependent on mills requiring massive power sources driven by water and later steam. Decades after the introduction of electricity, most plants still relied on networks of shafts, pulleys, and leather belts that were not so far from the world of the late 18th century millwright. With large investments in functional older systems, manufacturers often added electric motors controlling a group of machines while keeping the centralized power plants and drivetrains in place. This may have stretched the useful life of equipment, but it prevented the most efficient use of either old or new technology. Even managers optimistic about the ultimate benefits of powering each machine with its own electric motor may have rationally preferred to introduce electric power in a series of smaller-scale exploratory applications. By the 1880s, the advantages of powering each machine with its own electric motor were apparent. As a result, factories could run efficiently on a single skylit level. The literal overhead of noisy, oil-splattering drivetrain equipment could be eliminated. Materials and semi-finished work could circulate with less delay, as heavier machinery no longer had to be placed near the main shafts and drive belts. Workers could control machine speeds more precisely. Factories could make new goods that would have been difficult to produce with shaft-driven power. All these advantages were known, yet it took 40 years or more for all the elements to fall into place and for electrified factories to transform industrial processes and raise workers' standards of living and conditions in the 1920s. Replacing a big steam engine in the basement with a large electric motor was only a small first step toward more productivity. Not only the investment in older plants, but utility rates and the price of both electric motors and machinery helped determine the curve of investment in and benefits from electricity. And it took time to bring new single-story plants online. All this leads David to conclude that as different as information and electricity may seem, we may be looking too closely at the early problems of shifting from one set of structures to another. In manufacturing, electronically controlled processes have supplanted earlier systems much more swiftly than electric power replaced steam. Microprocessors and other solid-state components have improved reliability of many goods and lowered unit production costs by simplifying manufacturing and in turn raising sales. While electricity meant little more than light bulbs, even for the fortunate minority of consumers enjoying service in its early decades, the consumer electronics of the 1980s have brought radical changes at a faster pace. As recently as the early 1970s, a working four-function calculator was still an industrial-grade business machine that looked and cost the part, usually hundreds of dollars. Some electric adding machines did clunky semi-automatic multiplication, and there were exotic European handheld gizmos that looked like pepper mills, but nothing more. By the 1980s, solar-powered calculators no bigger than a credit card were selling for less than $10. The lag that David noted in reconfiguring industrial power to exploit the advantages of electricity does not seem to have occurred in the almost instant universal dissemination of microelectronic hardware. Statistics have nevertheless been discouraging. According to one study by the economist Stephen Roach, investment in advanced technology in the service sector grew by over 116% per worker between 1980 and 1989, while output increased by only 0.3% to 1985 and 2.2% to 1989. Two other economists, Daniel E. Sichel of the Brookings Institution and Stephen D. Oliner of the Federal Reserve, have calculated the contribution of computers and peripherals as no more than 0.2% of real growth in business output between 1987 and 1993. Meanwhile, manufacturing productivity was growing rapidly. One possible explanation, so far not systematically studied, is that the mediocre performance of the service sector is due to the average of results from companies that had done well along with others that had lost ground. Precisely because service companies now depend so much on computer systems, there is more to be lost as well as gained if technical bugs get out of hand. This is consistent with the shaky job security of chief information officers, CIOs, natural scapegoats for computer-related debacles, even when other managers may be more at fault. Some banks and brokerage houses seem to fire their CIOs almost every year, and more than a third of CIOs surveyed in the early 1990s reported that their predecessors had been forced out or down. But even if the problem has been high gains offset by high risks, rather than overall mediocrity of performance, something has not gone according to plan. Could the problem be system failures? Could hardware defects and software bugs be responsible for much of the loss in production? Computer catastrophes are definitely worrisome, especially for computer professionals. The details of known electronic disasters have filled whole books. Software code, like laws and sausages, should never be examined in production. Indeed, it seldom is, if only because today's developers write code in teams, each member producing a small part of an increasingly bulky and complex whole. There is no software equivalent of Tracy Kidder's hardware odyssey, The Soul of a New Machine. There is, however, an excellent contrast in Lauren Ruth Wiener's Digital Woes, the best general interest explanation to date of why and how computer software is inherently unreliable. Some of the stories she and others tell are chilling. In the mid-1980s, a computer at the Bank of New York began overwriting data on government securities transactions. Before the bug was discovered, the bank owed the Federal Reserve $32 billion without knowing who had bought what securities, and it ultimately lost $5 million in interest on a $23.6 billion loan it had to take from the Fed, pledging all of the bank's assets as collateral. At about the same time, cancer patients in Texas, Georgia, Washington State, and Ontario, Canada, received lethal X-ray doses from a software-controlled radiation therapy machine that failed after a specific sequence of commands to change its mode as instructed from a high-intensity X-ray beam to a low-intensity electron beam, while it nonetheless removed the tungsten shield that protects patients during X-ray sessions. Death and serious injury were the consequences. The Risks Digest, an internet bulletin board expertly moderated by Peter G. Neumann of SRI International, leaves little doubt about the hazards of software as readers throughout the world contribute cautionary tales. The ghastly consequences of some of these failures and the existence of computer codes that might automate nuclear strikes make complacency about electronic risks nearly criminal. But talking to computer support and maintenance professionals changes the picture. They believe that at least microcomputer hardware has, if anything, become steadily more reliable over time. Floppy disk drives and even hard drives fail much less often, even if they always seem to crash at the worst possible time. Some manufacturers in the early 1990s have announced MBTF, mean time between failure rates, equivalent to 30 years of continuous use. Not bad for equipment that may be socially obsolescent in 3 years because of new standards and capacities. As computer parts get cheaper, it is easier to protect systems by building in two or more of all crucial hardware items, especially hard drives. A computer with a RAID, random array of inexpensive disks, stores two or more copies of data. At a price, companies can regularly back up data to secure off-site storage services. Even if an office has to be evacuated for days or weeks, as happened after the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, employees can resume work in temporary quarters, a resilience impossible in paper-based offices. For both corporate and individual users, software failure is still not only a likelihood, but a certainty. Yet here, too, technology has taken the edge off the sudden disaster. The cost and ease of backing up large data sets continue to improve. Few computer buyers pay the $180 to $300 that a tape drive costs, but this is a trifling price for the security of being able to store hundreds of megabytes of data on a $25 tape. It's easy to program a computer to back itself up unattended during a lunch break or in the evening. There is still, of course, a burden of vigilance, shuffling floppy disks for the majority of users who still don't have tape backups, maintaining the discipline of backing up every single day, comparing backup data regularly with original files, and performing all the little rituals that are part of the technological strategy against catastrophe. Most network administrators now routinely back up files that reside on individual computers. Even viruses are less menacing now than they at first appeared to be. Not every virus is a serious threat to every computer user. Most users exchange programs and data intensively with a relatively small group of other users. According to researchers at IBM, few viruses reach the level, very similar to the infection threshold in medical epidemiology, at which they become stubbornly established in a population. To this social barrier is added the protection of antivirus software. This may be far from perfect, it's true. Once more, the price of protection is chronic vigilance. Here it means regularly downloading definitions for new viruses. Dozens are identified every month, and there are even underground toolkits, like legitimate software development packages, for creating new ones. A few viruses have been designed to attach themselves to popular antivirus software. It is also true that locating and eradicating a known virus on every single node in a corporate computer network might cost tens of thousands of dollars, because each workstation must be disinfected individually. Still, deleting and overwriting files accidentally, spilling beverages, forgetting one of those proliferating passwords, some managers must memorize dozens, and other mundane mistakes do far more damage, as yet, than all the world's diabolical code. One of the biggest computer outages so far, the crash of the AT&T telephone network in January 1990, resulted from a single ambiguous statement in the C programming language that controlled the system's switching center, not the criminal conspirators sought by police investigators at the time. The world's angry hackers will continue to be a chronic nuisance, and from time to time the source of local disasters, but not the great enemies of productivity some have portrayed them to be. The same can be said of power spikes. The two-strand telephone wires used in our homes and businesses were originally designed for voice communication, and only with great ingenuity can they be used for data transmission. Similarly, electrical networks were built to heat tungsten filaments and to power motors, not to regulate sensitive electronic equipment. Most people aren't conscious of voltage spikes and fluctuations unless their lights flicker visibly, but salespersons for surge suppressors do a brisk business at trade shows by plugging instruments that record each potentially dangerous spike into the exhibit hall power. These usually appear as though on cue. While operating a computer during an electrical storm is never advisable, the main danger is not a sudden power surge that fries the computer, though these certainly happen, but repeated smaller excess voltages that gradually reduce the reliability and life of components. Once more, what appears to be an acute threat is in reality a surprisingly incremental and chronic one. And this in turn creates a rearranging revenge effect for hardware protection. Most surge suppressors use varistors, zinc oxide wafers that react each time an excessive voltage passes through them, acting as electronic shock absorbers during transient high voltage peaks. Unfortunately, the equipment itself generally reveals no visible signs of these repeated blows the components have taken, or of the life left in the system. It would be as though there were no way, either from mileage or from its behavior, or even from an inspection, to tell the condition of a car's brake pads. To make things worse, when a powerful surge does come along, most protectors don't really suppress it. They send it into the ground with, logically, the grounding wire. The computer and other equipment, especially modems, are nearly always on the same grounding circuit, and it is not uncommon for the surge to be shot right back up into the equipment that is supposedly protected. I bought an expensive and well-reviewed unit that used a different technology, only to learn in a later review that it was susceptible to in-house surges that were no problem for good conventional units. The same review also asserted that the degradation of metal oxide varistors was not really a problem after all. The rating of my expensive surge suppressor had dropped to unsatisfactory. Surges are important enough to be a significant source of trouble and expense and another demand on vigilance, but not important enough to affect computer productivity significantly. As always, no technology, including manual and mechanical systems, is entirely safe. Nor do people invariably use the safest systems or use them with sufficient vigilance. But considering our dependence on electronic hardware, the important thing is not that it fails, but that off-the-shelf hardware has become more and more stable. We can rule out system failures as a big component of the productivity paradox. The problem is really in the software, and its use and misuse. Computers tend to replace one category of worker with another. There are two ways to get something done. You can find one group trained to accomplish things the old-fashioned way, or you can pay another group to set up and maintain machines and systems that will do the same work with fewer employees of the older category of worker. You are not really replacing people with machines. You are replacing one kind of person plus machine with another kind of machine plus person. When IBM persuaded corporations to modernize their bookkeeping in the 1950s, businesses were able to get along with far fewer accountants, as they expected, but they had to hire more programmers than they had anticipated. Automatic teller systems also require programmers and technicians paid four times as much as bank tellers. If things go well, banks need less than a quarter of the staff, and they come out ahead. But it is notoriously difficult to predict all problems or their levels of difficulty in advance. And one mark of newer technology is that while it is cheap in routine operation, it is expensive to correct and modify. We have all seen the sign, "The difficult we do immediately, the impossible takes time." Computerization turns this manifesto on its ancient head. Software can devour highly complex tasks with ease if they fit well into its existing categories. But even a simple change illustrates the revenge effect of recomplicating. The scientific typesetting program TEX, developed by the computer scientist Donald E. Knuth, and now the standard in many branches of physics and mathematics, makes short work of the most fearsomely complex equations that once cost publishers up to $60 per page to typeset. An author proficient in TEX, and I have had the good fortune to work with several of them, can prepare camera-ready copy that stands up to most commercially available systems. But making small changes, alterations that might require dropping in a metal slug or pasting in a new line in traditional systems, can sometimes take costly programmers' time. A hairline rule can take more time and money than pages of author-formatted proofs brimming with integration signs, sigmas, deltas, and epsilons. Minor incompatibilities between authors' TEX programs and publishers' typesetting equipment can delay book-length manuscripts for weeks and run up costs well beyond those of conventional typesetting. Worse still, from the publisher's point of view, some inexperienced and unskilled TEX-using authors, including distinguished scientists, blame the publisher and typesetter when their work is held up. As editors of conventional manuscripts, my colleagues and I could identify problems early and request changes before text went into production. Even experienced electronic manuscript specialists cannot evaluate a TEX manuscript reliably just by looking at the author's laser-printed version. Messy or non-standard coding may fail to reproduce the same beautiful output when fed into professional typesetting equipment. Consequently, there are real hidden productivity costs associated with an inexpensive TEX manuscript. It may require open-heart surgery rather than a haircut. Publishers and typesetters discovering such insurmountable glitches have been known quietly to set the author's electronic manuscript aside and dispatch the hard copy to Asian compositors for conventional keyboarding. This may be speedier than waiting for the author to learn the fine points of TEX, but it inevitably delays production, embarrasses author and publisher alike, and introduces new errors. What computerization offers, or simplifies, with its right hand, it can withdraw or recomplicate with the left. TEX demonstrates the additional burdens of vigilance that advanced technology imposes. It may slash production times and costs for a scientific or engineering publisher, but only if either, one, the whole burden of typesetting is shifted to the author, who then has to be knowledgeable and vigilant about levels of detail that copy editors and typesetters otherwise would supervise, or, two, the author's editor is prepared to spend hours learning the fine points of TEX, adding technical support to his or her job description. What about less esoteric programs, the word processors, spreadsheets, and databases that ordinary office workers use. Surely these have become easier. Text appears on screen more or less as it will on paper. What you see is what you get. Graphic user interfaces, GUIs, with colorful icons have replaced most of the mysteries of DOS command lines, which usually required constant reference to a manual. A good thing, because new documentation is notoriously skimpy. If everything is now so easy, why have there not been more gains in productivity? In fact, another set of revenge effects is at work. Graphic interfaces like the Macintosh System 7 and above, Microsoft Windows, OS 2, Next Step, and others actually do not simplify underlying programs. What they do is add all kinds of programs and files behind an organized facade. If things go right, as on a luxurious cruise ship, nobody worries about the engine room. When a problem does arise, though, the sheer number of elements and the unforeseeable ways in which they interact means that a high price may have to be paid for the seeming ease of everyday use, just as the levees, locks, and channels of the Army Corps of Engineers may tame the fair-weather river while shifting and even magnifying the destruction of floods when they come. In the world of computers, there are two solutions to this problem. One, adopted by Apple Computer for the Macintosh, is to police the system closely and enforce high compatibility and integration. Consistency has made Macintosh computers the easiest to learn and use, even when they have been somewhat slower in performing tasks than PCs running DOS with comparable processors. Apple's refusal to license the Macintosh operating system until the mid-1990s kept prices high, but also helped it maintain a more consistent user interface. On the other hand, it has always been more expensive to develop applications that meet these standards than to program for the original DOS, so there has been less choice, as well as less grief, for Macintosh users. Graphic artists and scientists are the exceptions. Their Macintosh applications are more abundant and powerful than DOS or Windows counterparts. In the mid-1990s, processor speed and storage capacity continue to grow exponentially, but operating systems and programs are multiplying their demands too. IBM's OS 2 2.1 took no less than 40 megabytes for full installation, more than many users' whole hard disks. Its successor OS 2, Warp 3, needs 65 megabytes. Microsoft Windows 3.1 plus MS-DOS needed 20 megabytes. Windows 95 requires 60. Rarer, more powerful systems like elegant Next Step 3.2 demand 120. The inflation of code, also reflected in 25-megabyte application programs, illustrates a chronic problem of computing that contributes to the productivity paradox. As swiftly as resources grow, the demands of software tend to expand even faster. Programmers and developers are understandably working for the future, preparing for the next generation of machines. Most users are living in the past because either their budgets or their bosses won't let them upgrade hardware to the current standard. Meanwhile, the planned obsolescence of software means that earlier versions of major programs may no longer be supported. Computer managers are moving users to Windows without always giving them the processor power, memory, or disk space to work effectively. For many users, computer software seems related to hardware, as Thomas Malthus believed population responded to food resources. Software does not just match, but eventually outstrips hardware in their respective rates of growth. Users who do not have enough computer power spend more and more time waiting for their systems to finish work or struggling with messages that protest accusingly, "out of memory." Even users with memory and disk space to spare are starting to think twice about upgrades. It is sometimes the applications that don't have the power to run under the new version of the operating system. Even the ardently pro-Windows PC computing had to acknowledge in late 1994 that many favorite applications simply would not work under the next release of Windows. By the mid-1990s, it appeared distinctly possible that operating systems were reaching a point of rapidly diminishing returns. Even when one's computer has power to spare, the techniques that make computers more user-friendly have revenge effects of their own. Take the icons that are replacing typed commands in controlling computers. Supplanting words with symbols is one of the great goals on the agenda of scientific idealism. Otto Neurath, a philosopher of the Vienna School, even founded an isotope institute, continued by his wife, to supply humanity and especially education with a universal iconic language. One of his disciples, a lawyer named Rudolf Modley, emigrated to the United States and founded the Pictograph Corporation, designing charts that conveyed information vividly and almost without words. Modley later collaborated with the anthropologist Margaret Mead and influenced generations of graphic designers. With growing regional and global movements of population, roadsides and airports sprout signs using standardized international pictographs in addition to, or entirely in place of, texts in one or more languages. Computer icons have the advantage of being more readily recognizable and distinguishable than strings of text. They also require less space. Pointing to an icon is also defended as more natural and intuitive than spelling out a request. In the normal course of education, one is taught to spell and not to point, but much of the appeal of icons, and even more elementary graphic interfaces like Microsoft's Bob, is their playful innocence. The trouble is that simplification can have its own recomplicating effects. At first, with only a small number of icons and a single organization, Apple, largely controlling their use, the idea proved a smashing success. The real problem surfaced when open standards were adopted to encourage independent software producers, while manufacturers, especially Apple, lost part of their control over the interface. Meanwhile, applications of software swelled in size with new features as developers sought to please users in many occupations with each program. Today, there are hundreds and perhaps thousands of icons in use, not to mention popular packages for creating and modifying icons. There are even animated and sound-enhanced icons, and no doubt some will soon be able to sing in 24-bit sound and four-part harmony. The recomplicating effect is that while some commands and programs are much clearer as symbols than as words, others are resolutely and sometimes inexplicably non-graphic. The world has at least two serviceable stop designs, but still no decent push and pull symbols for doors. "I love standards. There are so many to choose from," is a computer industry joke that applies to many icon designs. It probably does not matter too much that Apple Computer has copyrighted the Macintosh icon of the garbage can as a symbol to which unwanted files can be dragged for deletion. Windows software uses a wastebasket instead. But what does a shredder mean, then? Does it discard files, and/or does it do what paper shredders are supposed to? Make the original text impossible to recognize or reassemble? And some symbols mean different things in programs written for the same operating system. A magnifying glass can call for enlarging type, as it does in some Apple software, but it can also begin searching for something or looking up a file in Macintosh, as well as in Windows applications. A turning arrow can mean rotate image, but a similar arrow can denote undo. Microsoft tried 100 icons for undo and finally gave up. People might think of stop or greetings when they see an extended hand, and in some countries this might be an obscene gesture, but it is supposed to mean move through document. No wonder software producers are starting to add text to icons, sometimes in the form of pop-up balloons that appear when the cursor is moved over the icon, a recomplicating effect if ever there was one. And while the computer industry is rightly proud of the special features it has provided for people with disabilities, current reliance on graphic interfaces is at least a temporary setback for vision-impaired users, who will probably have to rely on voice synthesis. A survey by London's Royal National Institute for the Blind revealed that nearly three-quarters of software firms producing text-based software were planning to shift to graphic interfaces. Color, like symbols, also seems to make computers friendlier, although we have already seen that its introduction has been of doubtful benefit for user comfort. Moreover, spending more on color displays can actually reduce understanding. Most medical people prefer a grayscale for reading digital images. The eye can distinguish more shades of gray than of any other color, as many as 128 with special training and experience. While a color image appears richer in information, it actually may be misleading, though more interesting. Even professionals may focus on the wrong data because, like the rest of us, they attach special importance to certain colors that are coded for urgency in our culture. Red traffic signals and yellow highlighting, for example. The prominence of some colors can be equally deceptive. Yellow areas look larger than equal areas in blue because of yellow's higher luminance. It is hard to assign colors to data without subtly and unintentionally distorting information. Even following cultural conventions can be dangerous. If hot is coded as red and cold as blue, water faucet style, the brain has difficulty judging intermediate shades. Our perceptual systems let us see gradations along red-green and blue-yellow axes. A scale that mixes the two may look richer, but is not so clear. More information, in the shape of a richer color palette, may reach the brain as less understanding. Psychologists like Bernice E. Rogowitz at IBM Corporation and computer scientists are beginning to collaborate on tools for clearer presentation of data, but it probably will be years before these are adapted in common application software packages like spreadsheet and graphics programs. Until software incorporates good psychology, not only professional tools but essential everyday information sources like maps may be compromised. The geographer Marc Monmonier has observed that, quote, there is no simple, readily remembered, and easily used sequence of hues that would obviate a map reader's needing to refer back and forth repeatedly between map and key, unquote. Since many successful programmers of mapping software have no cartographic or design background, users of their products are as accident-prone as inexperienced hunters with hair-trigger firearms. If you see one coming, watch out. Whatever the perils of color, it is gaining and driving up the costs of computing. Color inkjet printers may be relatively inexpensive, but the color ink they use is costly. As the prices of standard laser printers fall, corporate buyers are eyeing color laser printers, a recomplicating effect that should also multiply the sales of color photocopiers. But just as video distributors have stopped colorizing classic films and art directors are exploiting the surprising impact of black and white in a polychrome media world, a stalwart minority of computer users are staying with monochrome monitors. The renowned economist Fisher Black, a managing partner at the investment banking firm Goldman Sachs, was still using his Compaq 386 as of early 1995. And was proud of having the only monochrome screen on his firm's trading floor. Adding the bugs and glitches of software to the limits and quirks of hardware is a recipe for problems that can easily wipe out the productivity gains in any system. This need not happen, of course, but the triumphs of computing are understandably reported more frequently than disasters that most managers would rather keep from customers as well as from the competition. The problem is usually not catastrophic, but, once again, gradual. What occurs is a slow leakage of staff time that does not show up in most statistics, but is nevertheless a drag on output. Sociologists of science and technology have long realized that getting both experiments and machinery to work takes skills that don't appear in textbooks or manuals. So-called high-technology professionals learn these, as artisans always have, by working with masters of the craft, and of course by trial and error. Some companies are lucky enough to have staff specialists who know how to coax programs, machines, and people into working well together, just as manufacturers have millwrights who, with nothing more than an ordinary toolbox, can get moving a stalled production line that would baffle managers and even most engineers. Despite 20 years or more of electronic diagnostics, automobile repairs still depend primarily on basic mechanical know-how and real-world expertise. Yet many organizations cannot find or afford the technical support they require. As the cognitive psychologist Thomas K. Landauer has observed, software is written by programmers whose logical, spatial, and mathematical skills exceed those of most users, and whose experience often blinds them to user needs. Some features, like the Windows games Minesweeper and Solitaire, have become major corporate time killers, and conscientious employees sometimes struggle for hours to get columns to align on their printers. behavior that a tongue-in-cheek survey by one software producer, SBT Accounting Systems, dubbed, quote, the PC futz factor, unquote. And according to the 3M company, 30% of business users lose data every year, costing an estimated 24 million business days to replace. As both software features and the numbers of users have multiplied, support by manufacturers has not kept up. Long waits and high charges are becoming more common, even when a bug in the product is at fault. Nearly 80% of companies increased their support costs between 1990 and 1995, but even in-house support cannot be ubiquitous. Filling the gap is peer support, the person down the hall who becomes a resource without any amendments to the job description. Many of these people can beat outside specialists. After all, they are likely to work with similar hardware configurations, using the same software for the same purposes. But there are also hidden costs involved. To help other users, relatively high-paid executives and professionals are spending time as peer consultants, time they have to take from their real jobs. Although the time thus lost never turns up as a line item on any financial statement, it means that these good Samaritans may never get around to refining a strategy further, to making an extra client presentation, or to doing any of a number of other income-producing things. The Boston consulting firm Nolan Norton & Company has documented what happens when organizations, among them AT&T, Bell Laboratories, Ford Motor Company, Harvard University, and Xerox Corporation, add workstations and networks without increasing support staff. Peer support expands to fill the gap. While journalists continue to celebrate the ever-lower prices of computers, the total cost of computing suggests that there is no such thing as a free menu. Nolan Norton found that a single PC workstation can cost up to $20,000 a year. Of this, $2,000 to $6,500 appears on the organization's information services budget as the cost of equipment, supplies, and in-house technical assistance. Peer support turns out to cost 2 to 3 times as much, or $6,000 to $15,000. The hours needed to help end users learn things and resolve problems seem to reach a natural equilibrium. Networking multiplies the need for support, and even among professional end-user computing staff, these needs change priorities. They spend most of their time reacting to problems and have less time for planning and implementing more effective enterprise-wide computing. Most peer support time is reactive, too. Peer support often turns out to be a rearranging effect. We save time by having computers accomplish things for us, but before they can do them, we take time from our colleagues. A local area network, LAN, may help a department work more effectively together, but it can also take hours of time as employees become administrators and assume the care and feeding of cables, interface cards, and networking software. The problem is more serious for those who do not have a formal role. Most amateur gurus do not mind interrupting what they are supposed to be doing. They may like computers more than their real jobs. Even if they love their work, they probably find peer help psychologically rewarding and politically valuable in accumulating allies and favors owed. Professional computer managers appreciate the volunteers for relieving their budgets and, of course, for knowing their colleagues' needs better than a full-time technical person could. Since some peer helpers are world-class scientists, engineers, and other professionals, the Information Services Department is getting a bargain, and the organization is losing a part of the high-priced time it is paying for. Yet without them, as William M. Bulkley wrote in the Wall Street Journal, quote, millions of U.S. workers might turn their PCs into expensive hat racks, unquote. One obvious solution is to bring support costs into the open by expanding budgets for information services to reflect the hidden demand. In the mid-1990s, however, corporations appear to be moving in the opposite direction, buying more and more bargain hardware and expecting the same staff to support it. Managers think that because local area networks are cheaper than mainframes, they should cost less to maintain. Actually, one consultant for network strategy, Janet Hyland, points out, quote, for client/server, ongoing support is much more costly than a mainframe, unquote. And she adds that, quote, no one will ever know how expensive it is, unquote, to support networks throughout a corporation. Despite industry call for usability, then, The computing world of the 1990s turns out to be a patchwork of standalone machines and networks, professionals and amateurs, always in a state of tension between the productivity benefits greater power brings and the learning and support costs that it requires. Whether by planning or by chance, some organizations have the people needed to make computers work brilliantly. These become the legends of the movement. Other organizations groan under the weight of their new machinery because they don't have people with the right skills in the right places. It comes as no surprise that computing, like most other forms of contemporary technology, is neither a miracle weapon nor a dud, but a set of tools that need constant attention and maintenance. The software crisis is yet another example of how the mastery of great tasks increases rather than reduces the chronic burdens of vigilance. Some say that this is a transitional situation, that computing is approaching a new stability and reliability. Users' experience with Windows 95 and applications written for it will be a good test of that claim. Technology is on a collision course with marketing, Forbes magazine warned a few months before the system's debut, as new home users fumed about their unruly machines, but early users were more positive. Meanwhile, something else is happening to software that calls the productivity of computing into further doubt. Well into the 1970s, computing was the rugged, Spartan territory of electronic data processing. Some people punched cards cut to the size of 1890s-era U.S. currency. Others fed the cards into readers and removed bulky, fan-folded, oversized paper from giant, clacking printers. A few lucky people, generally scientists and engineers, had terminals that could communicate with mainframes and mini-computers and even over networks. Some organizations had fancy daisy-wheel printers that could approximate the quality of an IBM Selectric typewriter, itself a spin-off of an early computer printer program. But there was nothing visually exciting about the vast majority of computers. Only a handful of pioneers saw that with enough processing power and memory, they could produce images that would speed use, aid analysis, and clinch sales. By the early 1980s, programs like VisiCalc and later Lotus 1-2-3 showed that computers could display information much more powerfully than anyone had thought. Large corporations have always invested heavily in graphic design and the production of charts, even for internal processes. Now, executives and professionals need no longer depend on artists and draftspeople. They can enter data and see it in tables, line charts, or pie and bar charts with a click of a mouse. They can print data as letters, numbers, or as real graphics. By the 1990s, organizations could buy equipment for $5,000 or less to make high-quality color slides and prints, and four-color laser printers in the same range have now come on the market in the mid-1990s. For $10,000 and up, dye sublimation printers can produce even more vivid images. All this represents a stunning achievement. Even in the late 1980s, a laser printer that could come near typeset quality, 600 dots per inch, sold for as much as $20,000, and early desktop publishers considered them bargains. A page that might have cost $15 or $20 to set conventionally could be generated in-house for little more than a dollar in paper and toner. Even when maintenance, power, and labor were counted, the savings were impressive. In 1992, my laser jet was already capable of 600 DPI at under $1,300. Equally to the point, it had dozens of standard typefaces built into it, making costly type cartridges unnecessary. Meanwhile, software had not stood still. Programs like Harvard Graphics, Lotus Freelance Graphics, Microsoft PowerPoint, and WordPerfect presentations let users mix text with images to create near-professional quality transparencies and slides. What, I wondered, is the connection to productivity? Among otherwise matched competitors, whoever has a powerful technology first has an obvious advantage. In war, it was horse-drawn chariots, then cannon, rifles, Maxim guns, submarines, decoding devices, atomic weapons. Technology does not always decide the contest, and sometimes the efficiency of shoe factories can count for more than the design of tanks, but nobody doubts the power of being first. In peaceful contests, the prize may go to the more powerful analysis, which is why mathematicians and economists can earn seven-figure incomes on Wall Street, but may also go to the more effective presentation. Not only marketers, but technical and medical researchers must learn to play the presentation game. In fact, scientists are so entranced with visual display that one of them, John Rigdon, has satirized their fixation with a hilarious account of Lincoln presenting a revised Gettysburg Address to accompany a set of slick transparencies. For years, economists have studied how competitors learn to fight against the successful early adopters of a new idea or technique. The value of powerful new instruments shrinks over time as more people have them and learn how to use them. When no other civilians had carrier pigeons, these birds were literally the highest financial technology. In 1815, they gave Nathan Mayer Rothschild several hours' advance notice of the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo, letting him make a fortune in stocks depressed by Blücher's recent defeat. No matter how much faster communications have become since then, the person with an online service can trade securities, short-term at least, better than one who scans the next day's financial paper. In turn, the subscriber to a quotation service with a 15-minute delay will beat the occasional user of the electronic news. The subscriber to a real-time service will have an advantage over the reader of delayed trading. And of course, where open outcry trading exists, somebody who has bought membership on the exchange can feel and hear the pulse of trading in the pits. Similarly, even powerful spreadsheet programs will not perform as well as applications developed for a single purpose or industry. Already, venture capitalists are tired of seeing business plans drawn up by a few standard software programs. No matter how efficient or cheap the technology becomes, a hierarchy remains. Retaining an edge remains costly. The search for graphic superiority is not new. After the relative restraint of Enlightenment design, the 19th century spirit of competitive enterprise promoted documents ranging from the elegant to the bizarre. Victorian circus posters and corporate letterheads alike testify to a zest for visual hyperbole, typographic tinkering, and virtuoso flourishes. Steel pens and cheap paper encouraged grand stylistic profusion, and ambitious white-collar workers took lessons from masters' penmanship in their quest for advancement. Copying all the letters in a big round hand was an important skill for the aspiring clerk. The Coca-Cola logotype, created in 1887 in the exacting Spencerian style by the Atlanta bookkeeper who also suggested the name, and the Teutonic Baroque Budweiser label of the same period, have outlived war, depression, and sans-serif functionalism. Modern presentations, like the Victorians' efforts, have a scale of values. The problem is that as elegant laser output gets more affordable and mail merge programs make customized form letters almost effortless, handwriting has moved up to the top of the executive communication scale. Top-of-the-line Mont Blanc, Waterman, Parker, and Pelican fountain pens cost more than many computer printers. The head of Mont Blanc's U.S. operations believes that when word processing removed the prestige once enjoyed by a flawless letter that only a top executive secretary could have typed, the handwritten note took its place. But many things still can't be handwritten, so graphic escalation continues, to the delight of hardware and software suppliers. The technology of the high end may change, but the cost of being on the high end apparently never goes down by much. Even the most enthusiastic fountain pen owners can write only a fraction of their communications by hand. Otherwise, they must compete for recognition with everyone else. After investing in the newest generation of equipment, one is at best only months ahead of others. Meanwhile, there is the cost of learning how to master the new capabilities. And here is where another chronic problem emerges. Even as the cost of equipment goes down, the increased power and flexibility of hardware and software make them take more time to learn and to use. Of course, they would probably be much quicker if one did the same old things. But there are always new things to be done. Some are automatic, like right-hand justification, which came to the office just when both psychologists and typographers were discovering that uneven right-hand edges are more legible and even more attractive because they permit the most consistent spacing. Most right-justified computer copy requires uneven padding between the words. It also requires minute variations of the distance between individual characters, letter spacing, a practice discouraged by traditional typographers. One of America's greatest, Frederick Gowdy, observed years ago, quote, Anyone who would letter space lowercase would steal sheep, unquote. As high-quality laser output has become increasingly available, and screen fonts like Adobe Type Manager and TrueType have made it easier to produce, the impact of computerized documents has declined. When Times Roman replaced ordinary Courier 10 as a standard, it became ordinary Times Roman. By March 1994, one type guru could even write a first law of fonts in a leading computer magazine. Quote, "Never use Times or Arial, the standard Windows sans serif font, for anything, ever," unquote. How long will it take for Baskerville, Garamond, and Palatino to share their fate? Laser printing has a way of turning even the best-designed types, and Arial, like Times Roman, is especially legible, into clichés. User problems hardly end once the proper type is at hand. The recomplicating effects of graphic interfaces continue to work their mischief when users share documents electronically. Any DOS text file can be read by any other DOS computer. A Windows file needs a copy of the original font on a recipient's computer to display the same carefully produced effects. If the font is not there, and if it is not one of the hackneyed standard fonts, it probably will not be, Windows looks for the next best thing, which usually looks much worse than the default DOS font. On the other hand, including multiple fonts in a file bloats the file and may violate copyright laws. Some complex programs promise to convert fonts attractively, but these take time to install and learn and may not be easy to use. Despite all the fuss that graphic escalation brings, what makes it most impressive is that it sometimes has no direct economic or competitive logic. A colleague who helps produce a newsletter for a local private school has told me how the school once managed very well with simple Macintosh output until new desktop publishing and page layout software became available. The new features were too much for volunteer editors, and the school had to hire a designer to lay out an attractive publication. Even if a new specialist does not show up on the books, the hidden costs of graphic escalation can be immense. Executives and support people spend hours, taken from other work, not to mention the time of their peer gurus, learning to make slides, handouts, and newsletters. The habit seems to be entrenched. A colleague teaching at the Sloan School of Management at MIT confirms that even some MBA students now feel that they are not sufficiently competitive if they fail to submit their coursework in color. By the mid-1990s, just as everyone seemed to have learned the ropes at last, the graphic escalator lurched upward again. This time the new dimension is multimedia, which means adding sound and fury to the smoke and mirrors. The cost of playing back multimedia files has plummeted as much as anything in computing. Before long, most personal computers will have a CD-ROM drive, a sound card, speakers, and a microphone as part of standard equipment. But as usual, when anything seems to be getting cheaper, a recomplicating effect is around the corner. Voice annotation of spreadsheets and other documents is a perfect example. Just when software was finally making it possible to share documents across computer systems and business programs, the multimedia document raises its head. It hogs disk space, remains partly unreproducible on most of the world's computers, erects new, if no doubt temporary, obstacles to file sharing, and above all, makes it impossible for anybody to get full information from a printout, no matter how many colors it may have. All this for what footnotes or an explanatory paragraph could accomplish at a fraction of the cost. Soon, we will no doubt be able to add video clips as well as sound to documents. Watching a video clip presents no problem, but producing video material is another question. The technological history of the motion picture industry suggests that every enhancement of the capabilities of a medium actually makes it more expensive. Refinements of science, far from ending the need for craft and for vigilance, create new categories of specialization and multiply their importance. Business people are not, in general, interested in animating three-dimensional dinosaurs or even two-dimensional ducks, but they share a problem with the George Lucases and Steven Spielbergs. More powerful hardware, even when it drops in price, does not run itself. The more awesome it is, the more skilled labor is needed to realize its potential, and in turn, the more production costs. In the early 1990s, the most stunning films using computer animation, despite budgets well into the tens of millions, could not afford much more than 10 minutes of real three-dimensional effects. Copyright owners will no doubt license some footage for corporate presentations at a price, as clip art is now sold as part of desktop publishing packages. But this will have its problems, as the bundled solutions will soon be overexposed. We've already seen how extensive use weakens the impact of printer fonts and business plan templates. And as Thomas Landauer has emphasized, many computer uses are unproductive. Quote, more concentration on operations and customer service applications and less on toys for professionals and managers is in order, unquote. What about analysis? Of course, computers take time to learn, and some people may miss the point. But who can deny that people think better, work better, analyze better, and write better with computers? Actually, there is growing evidence that computers may not be consistently better for real work after all. This suggestion infuriates many computer professionals. Industry columnists arguing vehemently with one another about almost everything else concur in denouncing anyone so perversely goofy as to doubt that computers really do make everyone more productive. For computer magazine editors and writers, there is no doubt that a rapidly changing industry promotes productivity. They would have very little to produce without a monthly shot of new hardware, programs, environments, and even operating systems. From 1981 to the present, American businesses have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on software to help improve decision-making. Software producers are now dispersing millions of dollars on research to make their programs even better and easier to use. Spreadsheets and other decision-making aids are now ubiquitous in academia and the professions, as well as in business. Thus, it is all the more remarkable how little research has been devoted to the effects of computers on the quality of decision-making. Given more data and more powerful analytic tools, is it reasonable to assume that the quality of decisions will be correspondingly higher? This may seem plausible and possible. It may even be true. Yet only a handful of studies exist. After all, why try to prove what everybody knows intuitively and what is built into the curriculum of business schools? The problem is that there is growing evidence that software doesn't necessarily improve decision-making. Jeffrey E. Kottman, Fred D. Davis, and William E. Remus, specialists in business decisions, tested the ability of a group of students to control a simulated production line under conditions of demand with a strong random element. They could add more workers with the risk of idle time on one hand, or maintain a smaller workforce with the risk of higher overtime payments on the other. They could restrict output relative to demand, possibly losing sales if orders jumped, or they could maintain higher output at the cost of maintaining possibly excessive inventory. The subjects, MBA student volunteers and experienced spreadsheet users, were divided into two groups. One group was shown a screen that prompted only for the number of units to produce and workforce level. The other group could enter anticipated sales for each proposed set of choices and immediately run a simulation program to show the varying results for projected inventory. They could immediately see the costs of changing workforce levels, along with overtime, idle time, and non-optimal inventory costs, all neatly displayed within seconds after entering their data. They had no more real information than the first group, but a much more concrete idea of the consequences of every choice they made. If all we have read about the power of spreadsheets is right, the what-if group should have outperformed the one with more limited information, unable to experiment with a wide variety of data. Actually, the what-if subjects incurred somewhat higher costs than those without the same analytical tools, although the difference between the two groups was, as expected, not statistically significant. The most interesting results had less to do with actual performance than with the subjects' confidence. The non-what-ifs rated their own predictive ability fairly accurately. The ratings that subjects in the what-if group assigned to their own performance had no significant relationship to actual results. The correlation was little better than if they had tossed coins. Even more striking was how the subjects in the what-if group thought of the effects of their decision-making tools. What-if analysis improved cost performance for only 58% of the subjects who used it, yet 87% of them thought it had helped them, 5% believed there was no difference, and only 1% thought it had hurt. This last-mentioned subject was actually one of those it had helped. Another experiment had an even more disconcerting result. Decision makers were indifferent between what-if analysis and a quantitative decision rule, which, if used, would have led to tremendous cost savings. In other words, the subjects preferred what-if exploration to a proven technique. Why the attraction of what-if analysis? Perhaps the subjects, being MBA student volunteers, had a strong belief in their ability to manipulate numbers. But that does not explain why they also rejected a carefully formulated equation in the second experiment in favor of free-form interaction. The real reason, Davis and Kottman surmise, must be what psychologists call the illusion of control, the way we can easily convince ourselves, given the proper setting, that we are making things happen, when in reality they are chance events. Both the beauty and the risk of computerized analysis is the concreteness it can give our plans, even when our underlying data are doubtful and our models untested or even wrong. We have seen the theatrical power of computers. In the illusion of control, we turn it on ourselves to reassure ourselves that the powers we possess are indeed real. Computer advertising appeals to this sense of control, and in fact it often is real control, at least in the right hands. But consider all the hardware and software producers who have failed or lost tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. Surely their employees and at least some of their executives were among the world's most proficient users of computers of all kinds, with IBM at their head. And surely they used the best models and techniques available. But the losers faced situations in which what-if questions are of limited value, in which politics, distribution, the evolution of standards, and sheer bluff matter as much as technical excellence. Of course, we can't go back to graph paper, slide rules, pencil marks, and eraser shavings, but we do not seem to be moving forward as rapidly beyond the present categories of software as we might, despite the extravagant early promises of artificial intelligence research. In fact, some old-style financial executives still astound younger colleagues by using slide rules and mental techniques at meetings to get faster results than the others obtain from their calculators and notebook computers. Spreadsheets are still valuable tools, but they are more like lathes than can openers. They need careful setup, adjustment, and oversight. The decision scientists Raymond R. Panko and Richard P. Halverson, Jr., found that while spreadsheet users have a low error rate at the cell level, 0.9 to 2.4%, these errors cascade into disturbingly high error rates at the bottom line, 53 to 80%. As the logical intricacy of spreadsheets increases, the error rate also grows, a recomplicating effect. When a bug in mathematical operations of the Pentium chip in 1994 alarmed users, few understood that their own mistakes in entering data and failure to debug their programs were a far greater risk to their results than the problems of Intel's processor could ever be. Spreadsheet users, like other beneficiaries of technology, have not realized that the way errors propagate from step to step in a program is yet another chronic problem of technology. The answer is that, once more, a labor-saving technology needs a surprising amount of time-consuming vigilance to work properly. To return to Paul David's comparison of electric motors and electronic workstations, could it be that only now are we starting to see the beginnings of new structures that will make possible the kind of productivity increases that manufacturing enjoyed in the 1920s? Networks seem to be rebuilding organizations in new ways. If only there were at least basic agreement on what is happening. On the one hand, networks are said to inject grassroots democracy and equality, ushering in a kind of corporate new age where rank and title matter less than the quality of a contribution, bare as electronic mail is of the usual trappings of executive office. Documents can be transmitted and processed with new speed, sent between employees with different computer types and operating systems. Electronic meetings can open the floor to ideas of those who might otherwise have been pushed to the sidelines by superiors or more aggressive colleagues in a conventional face-to-face session. Regrettably, an in-house computerized meeting room costs $50,000 to $200,000, and outside providers charge thousands of dollars a day for their use. The flip side of the innately democratic network is the malignant authoritarian network. where some find inventiveness percolating up and correspondingly rewarded, others find discipline and punishment raining down and privacy trampled underfoot. If networks appear to open channels previously barred, and it's not clear how having to put ink on paper ever prevented sending a message to top management, they also make it possible to read files surreptitiously, monitor activities, and even trace message traffic to discover clusters of malcontents. Aside from such ethical lapses, a collegial style doesn't necessarily mean a flattening of power. The InfoWorld magazine columnist Robert X. Cringely suggested not so long ago that the casual culture of Microsoft masked a management style that was at heart not so different from the hard-driving ways of the robber barons. You can work any 80 hours a week you want. Of course, an authoritarian organization can be extremely productive, whether or not the iron fist is in a faded denim glove, but there is no evidence that networks, as such, make managers different. Rather, people seem to build networks in their own image. Apart from issues of democracy and authority, computers have encouraged a trend that may have unintended results for corporate efficiency, reducing support staff. The American Manufacturing Association, in a much-noticed study, found that staff reductions in general did not reliably increase profits. At downsized companies, profits increased for only 43% of firms, and actually dropped in 24% of those studied. Almost as many reported a drop in worker productivity as reported an increase. If computers really made it possible for a smaller number of people to accomplish the same amount of work, there would be little outcry about longer hours for middle managers and professionals. In fact, after examining 20 case studies in 5 major U.S. corporations, Peter G. Sassone, an economist and management consultant, concluded that computerization has helped reduce, rather than promote, the amount of time that these employees spend performing their highest and best work. Sassone found that many highly paid people were spending a significant amount of their time performing what amounted to secretarial and clerical functions, usually working with computers, but often not doing what they spent years at college and graduate school learning to do. Why not? One reason is that companies tend to expand by adding professionals and to cut back by laying off support staff, giving them a top-heavy structure. Another is that computer systems make it possible for managers to do more things for themselves. Their jobs become more diverse in a negative way, including things like printing out letters that their secretaries once did. Sassone's analysis suggests that the increased productivity of office technology has an, quote, indirect and unintended effect on staffing that may cause overall organizational productivity to decline, unquote. This he calls the law of diminishing specialization. This is just fine for many people. Either you like the division of labor or you don't. Some social workers and some people in business believe that doing your own word processing, filing, and so forth builds character. But economic theory suggests that it doesn't do much for profits. The most rational way to deploy staff is to have the most skilled and specialized employees working as much of the time as possible at the highest level of specialization, while less skilled and lower paid staff should take over the rest of the work. A famous pre-computer textbook example is the story of the best lawyer in town who was also the best typist in town, but who would look foolish not employing a typist. Computers can create an illusion that the machine is doing all the work, but a surprising amount actually remains: formatting letters, replenishing and unjamming paper, replacing toner, and of course addressing and stuffing envelopes. Professionals who are doing these things aren't doing other, more productive things. Of course, top executives understand this pitfall when it comes to themselves. They rarely cut back on their immediate support staff. Sassone claims that by reversing the formula and employing fewer managers and professionals and more support staff, corporations could achieve savings of $7,400 per employee. What keeps them from doing this is another form of the illusion of control, in this case the misconception that now support functions can take care of themselves. The relentless speed and efficiency promised by microcomputers and networks, their computation capacity doubling every 18 months, has a catch. The more powerful systems have become, the more human time it takes to maintain them, to develop the software, to resolve bugs and conflicts, to learn new versions, to fiddle with options. Once again, the intensity of a given technology may bring repeating and rearranging effects in its wake. Early computer-minded historians were overjoyed at their new powers of quantitative analysis until they realized that they would probably have to spend months or years entering data by hand before a machine could spend its few minutes processing and analyzing the data. One approach to computers and productivity is to insist that many benefits of computing defy conventional measurement. If anything should change, it is the methods of economists, not the claims of the computer industry. A more radical form of this argument is that the point of the computer is the pleasure of mastering and using it, its responsiveness when things go well. In this view, that game of Minesweeper on an employee's monitor should not make the boss scowl. There probably is something to learn from it. Computerization is as much an end as a means. Nearly every computer user must feel such joy when things go right, seeing the first gorgeous page of text from a new program or printer, for example, that it seems crass to talk profit and loss. But this approach ignores the times of correspondingly great frustration. Some programmers are repeat keyboard smashers, and if personal experience is paramount, what of the countless people who still enjoy manual ways of doing things? For both technophiles and technophobes, the best and perhaps the only way to avoid the revenge effects of computing is to maintain skills and resources that are independent of the computer. We can learn back-of-the-envelope calculation to beware of misplaced decimal points. We can work on face-to-face and telephone relationships with colleagues and outsiders to avoid the misunderstandings of excessive reliance on electronic mail. In a way, the problems of computers, like so many other revenge effects, have reminded people of the value of other things. In the first decade of computing, handwriting and handwritten letters began to rebound from years of neglect. Bugs, glitches, and crashes have a positive side. They are the machine's way of telling us to diversify our attention, not to put all of our virtual eggs in one electronic basket.